Hi, and welcome to DebtWired. I'm Andy Serby, Deputy Courts Editor at DebtWire. If you're a Legal Lens listener and feeling a little confused at the moment, here's an update. We're going to be joining the DebtWired umbrella moving forward, but continuing with the same great content at the same frequency discussing legal issues impacting the restructuring industry. I'm excited to introduce our content to a new audience and to join my colleagues under a more comprehensive banner, giving our listeners a true one-stop shop. Now, let's get on to today's episode. Today, I'm glad to be joined by a group of attorneys from Sullivan and Cromwell, getting into their first-person perspective on one of the biggest bankruptcy cases in our recent memory, FTX. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thank you.
So I want to give you guys a chance to self-intro. Since there's three of you, I think it's easiest if we do it from your end.
Sure. I'm Andy Dietrich.
I'm Brian Glutstein.
And I'm Jake Crook, and we're all partners here at Sullivan and Cromwell.
Great. So I think it makes a lot of sense to take this kind of chronologically. So let's rewind to November a couple of years ago. In the early days, how do you get around wrestling this case to the ground? Obviously, the first order of operations is getting it into safe hands. Maybe this is best for Andy or Brian.
I'll take that one because I got the call, so to speak. I had been happily working away for the U.S. business of FTX, who had signed a contract to buy Voyager out of bankruptcy. And I was their bankruptcy attorney for that transaction. We hadn't worked, or at least I hadn't worked, with the rest of the business around the world. But on, I think it was Tuesday of that week, I received a call out of the blue from the number two and number three legal officers for FTX worldwide. And they informed me that somewhere between $8 and $9 billion was missing from the main exchange. And we immediately began a process to think about what to do about that problem. We didn't know really much at the time, but we knew that the main legal officer of the company couldn't be found. And we knew that many of the principals of FTX, including Sam Bankman-Fried, were not going to be engaged in what we might call the restructuring effort, but were instead trying to figure out whether they could raise some emergency capital to keep things afloat. And so we started to initiate a checklist that we run through for these crises and to figure out if we needed to stabilize what was becoming an international bank run, how we would do that on the facts of FTX. What we learned very quickly is that the company was not a model of corporate organization. We were not regular counsel to the company, so we didn't have an org chart. And we requested and bought an org chart from their normal corporate counsel. It had about 130 companies on it. And what we think of as FTX wasn't a corporate group with a parent company. It was just this collection of companies all around the world. One of them was very important, FTX Trading Limited, which was the company that owned the main exchange. And so normally, best practice is if you start to do contingency planning to put something in, say, a bankruptcy filing in the United States, you have board meetings. And you find who's on the board of all the different companies, and you have board meetings or joint board meetings, and you talk to the board, and you have an organized process, and they all vote to potentially file for Chapter 11 if that's what's necessary. And this was becoming, at this point, pretty clear that filing for Chapter 11 was going to be necessary to stop the bank run. I remember we looked at the first company, FTX Trading Limited, and saw there were three members of the board. Two of those we couldn't find. One was Sam Bankman-Fried, and the other was another employee that had left. The chairman of the board, though, was a lawyer in Antigua. And so I remember calling the lawyer in Antigua and saying, I'd like to talk to you about this company, FTX. And he responded, what's FTX? And I said, FTX is a international cryptocurrency company, and we need to talk urgently about its liquidity situation. He said he would check his files and call me right back. And 5 minutes later, he resigned by email. What was the largest company in the corporate family? And there were 129 others. So we immediately had to figure out how we would, with the knife falling very quickly, organize a filing for a company that didn't appear to have board meetings, even for its major companies, let alone organize books and records. And that was the main challenge for the first days of FTX. Ultimately, what we decided to do was to recognize that Sam Bankman-Fried had effective control over all of these 130 companies. And we drafted a very special piece of paper, which I've never done before, called an Omnibus Corporate Resolution, pursuant to which Sam signed over his authority, such as it is around the world, to John Ray, an appointed CRO / CEO, a restructuring expert. And that then became very quickly our client as we filed for Chapter 11. But it was certainly an exigent situation. I think people don't often realize that we were the third FTX bankruptcy, not the first FTX bankruptcy. There had already been proceedings in the Bahamas and in Australia by the time that we managed to gather the rest of the companies and file them for Chapter 11 in the United States.
So now that we've got our arms started to get around the early days of the case and we've gotten past the resignation of our Antiguan friend, Jake, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how this case felt different or broke down differently in the early days from, we've already referenced Voyager, but listeners might also call to mind other crypto cases like Celsius or Three Arrows.
Sure. So this was a very different kind of crypto bankruptcy. It took weeks for us to even really get our arms around what the liabilities were, who we owed them to, but more importantly, what those liabilities were. It was a situation where it wasn't just that we owed customers somebody a Bitcoin, somebody ETH, and three or four different assets. There were, by the time we finally got around to wrapping everything up, there were over 1,300 different assets that customers had claims as to, where each one of which had to be valued. We had to determine how much of them we had, how much of them were owed, and reconcile that whole mishmash of assets. And the problem that we ran into was also not that it was a situation where you owe people Bitcoin and ETH, and then you've got maybe a 20% shortfall in each of them. There were assets where we had most of what we owed people, and other assets where there was just almost none. Bitcoin was one of the main examples where FTX.com, as of the petition date, collectively, there were customers who had liabilities of around 100,000 Bitcoin, and FTX.com itself had just over 100. 99.9% of the Bitcoin was gone. And trying to reconcile that and figure out how to deal with the different assets and the shortfalls was really something.
The other thing that makes a difference with the other crypto cases is we knew from the beginning that the circumstances that we were dealing with, although at this time we had no indication there was yet a crime committed, we had indications that they were highly suspicious. And so we were focused very early, not on the usual, hey, everything's rosy. This is just a great company with a broken balance sheet. We were focused very early on making sure that we had a clean break from the prior regime, that we had a new team in terms of John Ray and the board of directors. We eventually repopulated the entire board of directors. We held, I think, many of the first board meetings these companies had ever presumably had, and established proper corporate governance. As soon as we did that, we realized we didn't know enough about the company to speak much about it publicly. So we had a almost two and a half week period of time after filing where we didn't talk because we weren't confident yet that we could say things accurately. And even when we did speak, we did it in the form of that first day declaration, which was news around the world, which was an honest and transparent description of effectively the missing information, the informational problem at FTX, that we didn't know where our money was. We didn't know who were employees. We didn't know whether the systems by which we held digital assets were secure or not secure. We didn't trust our accounting results. We had no reliable historical financial information. We didn't have books and records for many of the companies, which appeared to never have had books and records, not just the question of having them lost. And so that first day declaration was really intended to make it clear to the world that this was a different kind of a case. This was a case that, in the words of John Ray, was not just an insolvency, it was also potentially a crime scene. And we had to proceed deliberately to rebuild credibility with the world. And that was a very different way of approaching a bankruptcy case than I think the other crypto cases have decided to do.
We also knew during that period of time, during that 2 week or so blackout, where we were getting our arms around the situation at the company, that we did not know where all the assets were. And because of that, we also knew that there was a high probability that assets would disappear. And so a lot of the work in those early days was focused on securing assets, locating assets, ensuring that we obtained relief from the court that would allow us to conduct business in a way that debtors don't always do, not immediately in the public sphere. We would get there, but we knew that we needed to work to secure and locate every asset that we could, or we were facing a situation between bad actors and the management team at the company who we had detached from, potentially walking off with all the assets of the company, leaving the creditors with nothing.
Yeah, I called this a bank run earlier, but in many ways, the bank run's easier because you have the cash in a vault. These were assets that by their very nature could disappear instantaneously. And the security arrangements by which FTX held customer property could be characterized any number of ways, but entirely absent would not be far off. For example, access to the main system by which customer property could be moved and traded was a single root email that was accessible by potentially dozens of individuals. And so we had real worries that these digital assets would disappear if too many people had too much information about their scope or extent. And that fear was, I think, validated by one of the things that happened right after we filed. I remember this. We'd been working around the clock for days, finally get the company in, go home to get a few hours of sleep. And the first thing that happens are simultaneous black hat hacks with various people moving against the assets that we had and our need to immediately take steps to try to move them into cold storage. So I remember the first days of the case under the protection of the automatic stay were really focused on making sure that we could take assets from unreliable systems as best we could and move them into cold storage as quickly as possible. Again, not a usual thing for a bankruptcy.
And I'm not saying it never happens, but it's also not a typical thing where you proceed through a bankruptcy where, to your point about the crime scene thing, we'd be remiss to not mention that Sam Bankman-Fried has been convicted of actual crimes. So I don't know if anyone wants to specify what he really is in jail for.
Sure. I think on this point, one misconception that gets thrown around a little bit about this is that the whole FTX situation leading up to the collapse was just the result of either an accident or bad risk management or negligence or something like that. In the very early days, it was really hard to tell. We did not have much information about what had actually happened. We didn't have a full picture. But I think it started to become clear pretty quickly. And I think during the course of the trial that you mentioned, the story about what really happened was spelled out in a lot of detail. There was dozens of witnesses that came forward and documentation that really showed the story there. And at its core, what it really boiled down to was the way the exchange worked was customers could either deposit an asset and trade that, which was the sort of the more basic spot trading, or they could deposit cash or other assets to be used as collateral and then take derivative positions off of that, often with leverage. And the system was designed to have all sorts of controls in place to ensure that no one customer could end up with so much exposure to the exchange that if things went wrong, that would cause a real problem. And that system generally worked in a pretty automated way and applied to most people. But Alameda, one of the core entities to the group and the fund that Sam controlled, was not subject to many of those same requirements, and in fact had specific exemptions to several different technical limitations that were built into the code there. And more than that, I think as was discussed at the trial, it wasn't just that the code didn't prevent Alameda from taking these big positions, but rather that Sam and his group of co-conspirators, in fact, intentionally used that access to take very large positions and to withdraw funds from the exchange that in fact had been deposited by other creditors. And those funds were used for all manner of things, whether it was for business growth or personal investments, or planes or venture book stuff. And I think what the evidence that came out of trial showed was that the hole grew over time. And by the time of the collapse, it had just gotten too large to cover up any further.
And going back a little bit to the question of approach, this is a question more for Brian than anyone, but a key part of wrangling the claims before we move on to a discussion about the recoveries is dollarization and what was one of the big fights, which was the estimation motion. Could you speak to that at all?
Absolutely. So as was indicated, one of the big differences here from some of the other cases that you mentioned, taking Celsius as an example, this is not a situation where we were ever going to be in a position to just return cryptocurrencies to customers. And there's really two reasons for that. The first is that we didn't have a lot of the cryptocurrency due to the rating of the customer deposits and entitlements that Jake just spoke to. And the second is that a lot of the customer claims on the exchange were not for cryptocurrency assets. They were for cash claims as a result of derivative and other trading activities. And so it was clear to us that our plan of reorganization was going to have to be necessarily a dollarized claims plan where customers were going to be paid in U.S. dollars the value of their claim as of the petition date, which is as required by the bankruptcy code. And one of the biggest challenges we had was, given that universe of 1,300 plus assets that Jake referred to, that customers had entitlements to, was valuing those claims on the petition date. And it was evident that for any plan of reorganization to be successful and return fair value, both we as the debtor and customers needed to understand how those various entitlements were going to be valued. And so we decided fairly early on in the case, before we ever were in a position to present a plan of reorganization, to go to the court and ask the bankruptcy court to use the court's estimation powers to provide the necessary certainty and transparency to all stakeholders as to how cryptocurrencies were going to be valued on the petition date for purposes of claims and for other purposes in the case. And so we actually looked at and we brought in experts to do analysis, to look at the holdings of FTX, what tokens were actually in our physical possession, and make a determination as to how to value the various tokens and cryptocurrencies. And a big issue that we faced was for some of these cryptocurrencies that were widely traded, like Bitcoin, that was a more certain and clear process on how to value. But for most of the tokens that were less well known and had much less liquidity in the market, any trading price that might be cited to was not accurate, because if we were in a position where the estate needed to liquidate its holdings in a particular token that Sam Bankman-Fried was behind creating, and FTX held 95 or 100% of the total issuance of the tokens, there would be no way to monetize those tokens for value, whether it be us or the customers, in a way that would give the price on a much more limited set of liquidity in the market. And so we came forward with a schedule of how to discount, where appropriate, certain tokens. There were locked tokens that needed to be accounted for. We came up with a comprehensive 1,300 plus itemized list of how to value these tokens, and we took it to court. And there were, of course, objections that were interposed. Many of those objections from customers who believed that the price that we were proposing was lower than they saw in the market, thought that was unfair. And we actually had two different trials on the matter to address various objections. And ultimately, the court set the price of each and every one of those tokens. And what that allowed us to do was then, when we got to the point of having a plan of reorganization, all stakeholders, all customers could see, here's what my claim will be worth in dollars as of the petition date. And that allowed everybody to make an informed decision whether to support or not the plan that was proposed. So that early action to solve what was a very difficult problem was not easy to do and required, as I said, multiple hearings. But once we were able to do that, it very much helped clear the path towards building consensus around a plan.
Another thing that was interesting about FTX as a juxtaposition to some of the other crypto cases is, let's assume a different company. Let's assume a company that was basically in the spot crypto business and had seven different cryptocurrencies. And maybe it had a little bit of a shortfall somewhere and a credit loss, but it basically had the cryptocurrency that corresponded to customer entitlements. You could see that bankruptcy being run in a way that was really designed to return to customers, quote, their cryptocurrency, because their cryptocurrency was more or less in the possession of the debtor. Our facts could not be more different than that. Right? First, as Jake mentioned, the vast majority of exposure on FTX.com was derivative, meaning people, for example, if they wanted Bitcoin exposure, would post dollar margin, and that dollar margin would go up and down based upon the fluctuations in the price of Bitcoin. And so what we're dealing with immediately was a derivative book, fundamentally, not a spot book. The second difference was that even for the spot book, the numbers that all the customers around the world had on their iPhone and on their computer had very little to do with the reality of what was actually in the vault at FTX. There was no daily reconciliation of these positions. And as Jake mentioned, 98, 99% of the Bitcoin, 97% plus of the ETH, most of the dollars, all the good stuff, for lack of a better word, was gone by the time we opened it. And so there was no way to run an estate designed to return property to customers in kind because we didn't have the in-kind assets. Instead, we had a collection of everything that money was used for, right? And litigation claims and other sources of recovery. FTX did not return the result that it's returning because of an appreciation in the price of cryptocurrency locked up at FTX.com. It did that because of the hard work of chasing where that money went all around the world.
Right. And I think that is just a beautiful transition point to what I think a lot of people are going to look back and remember other than the free fall into bankruptcy, which is the triple digit recoveries that a lot of the creditors are going to be seeing. So going to Brian first, I want to talk about the litigation angle. What role did that play from your perspective?
The actual litigation and the threat of litigation was extremely important. So after we shored up the assets that we still had access to either directly or could get our hands on to pull with into the estate, we quickly started to identify where assets had left FTX pre-petition. And we put that list together and it was vast and the numbers were staggering and the ways in which that value had been lost were staggering, many of which had just been money that had been either co-invested or donated or otherwise just given by Sam and the other co-conspirators to third parties. There was assets that had seeped out of the system through other employees, through other ventures. And so we very quickly started making phone calls to people and said, you have two options. We will sue you in the bankruptcy court and we will claw this money back as fraudulent transfers, or you can repay it. And in many instances, people voluntarily did agree to repay large sums of money to the estate because we asked them to, and they were not willing or interested in having a public litigation fight. And so holding that over everybody's head was very important. There were other people who saw what was happening and were worried about being put into litigation in a way that would have been damaging perhaps to their business, and called us and said, we know you're going to be suing people and you might not know this, but we have some money we'd like to return. But then most importantly, against that backdrop, we did sue a number of people, and we filed some very big lawsuits very early on in the case. We immediately became focused at John Ray's direction on clawing those assets back and not waiting until later stages of the case to bring fraudulent transfer and other litigation claims. We got out ahead of that issue. We filed very large lawsuits, nine-figure lawsuits early on, and had success in resolving those lawsuits in favor of the estate and bringing money into the estate. And that started to snowball in a way that really allowed us to augment those recoveries. So there, of course, were holdouts and there remain holdouts. There's a number of cases that are still pending that we believe will bring additional significant value into the estate when they're adjudicated. But given the scope of the issues that we had, the litigation tool and using that tool early on in the case was very successful in augmenting the value of the estate for all stakeholders.
And going to another prong of the recovery story, I want to talk a little bit about assets. So talk about forfeitures and the investments like the Anthropic one that we all remember that were pretty successful. And I think that's a question that we can pose to Jake.
Yeah, I think from the beginning of this case, once we started working with the government on this and responding to the requests, they at a very early stage had seized certain assets that they had determined were forfeitable proceeds of crime and that have remained in government custody throughout the pendency of the criminal cases. We also have been chasing assets on our end, as Brian mentioned, around the world and recovering things there. And we obviously want to make sure that we're maximizing value for our creditors. And the government has an interest that's both just the government's interest, but also their mandate by statute to ensure that any assets that are forfeited are used for the victims of those crimes. And we came to the view very early on that when you look at the universe of victims of the crimes that the government charge and the creditors of our estate, they're very similar. It's two very overlapping circles. And we worked very closely with the government throughout this process on coming up with a structure that would allow us to ensure that at the end of their forfeiture process, the assets that were subject to forfeiture would be used for victims. that we would be able to use the existing infrastructure of our plant to most efficiently and most expeditiously get those assets back to the victims who are the creditors here. And that involved not just working on the forfeiture piece, but also working out a pretty complicated structure with respect to the other government claims that were coming in. I don't know, Andy, if you want to talk about that.
It's hard to stress enough that the true reason why we've done well at FTX from a recovery perspective is because of the support of the government stakeholders. And as Jake said, it wasn't easy, and I don't think it's been done in the way we've done it before. But from the beginning of the case, we kept repeating the same phrase, at first aspirationally, and then I think it gradually became our reality. And the phrase was, all victims are creditors and all creditors are victims. And what that meant to us is, how do we reconcile a set of laws that are designed to recover value for people that have been hurt and to give them that value fairly, but are very different systems? On the one hand, you have Chapter 11 and strict rules about valuing claims as of the petition date and rules about the equality of different creditors, a rule that says shareholders come behind creditors, and a U.S. judge who is used to applying the bankruptcy code in a certain way. Then we have the Bahamas and an entirely different set of insolvency regulations. They had important assets. We needed to reconcile that to run a global distribution process. Then we have the DOJ. As Jake mentioned, they had forfeiture proceeds of significance. They would normally, if you look back at, say, the Madoff example, have a completely separate distributional scheme with different ways of measuring customer losses and give the money to different people in a different priority at a different time at great cost and confusion. So we wanted to reconcile that. Then, importantly, we had our primary regulators, all of whom had big regulatory claims and were interested in making sure that what value was available to pay those regulatory claims would go to victims, as they were willing to define victims. And finally, we had the IRS. And the IRS had filed a, I forget the number, Brian, but it was like a $40 billion tax claim. Repeat that, a $40 billion priority tax claim. At the end of the day, FTX paid a $100 million cash payment, but the IRS's tax liability, pre-petition and in administration, has been subordinated to victim recoveries under a whole separate IRS doctrine about how the IRS will take a backseat to the legitimate victims of fraud. And so what we did in the case, bit by bit, settlement by settlement, is reconcile each one of those different distributional and valuation regimes into our Chapter 11 plan, and have that plan supported by all of those various government authorities. And that means at the end of the day, not only are victim recoveries not diluted by taxes, but we're able to pay people more than strict bankruptcy value, because the CFTC has a claim and the CFTC has agreed that we can use value distributable otherwise to the CFTC to pay victims. And in addition, the DOJ has agreed that their forfeiture recoveries can be distributed to victims using our infrastructure in the Chapter 11 case. That's really a major driver of recoveries, worth billions and billions of dollars. And it all is a result of that early posture we had of cooperation with the government authorities and the hard work with us and them to make sure that we can reconcile these various laws in a single plan of reorganization.
Those claims, as big as those numbers are real claims. They're allowed claims. They're important claims that need to be satisfied. And so the trust will continue to work to bring assets in to satisfy those claims. And what Andy just described is of critical importance, because what it means, due to the cooperation of all of these different government agencies, and many of them had to be convinced, but what it does is it allows, as those recoveries come in, instead of those monies going into federal, state, or other countries' government coffers, they're going out to customers as and creditors as victims. And that was a really important piece for us to allow us to really deliver value to the customers here. And that really did allow us to come to, in hopefully what we're ultimately is going to be at a much higher number than certainly anybody was anticipating the combination of finding those assets, having those assets, and having the cooperation of those claim holders to make sure that the victims here get as much of the value as possible is really how the plan shapes up to deliver the sort of numbers that you talked about at the outset.
And look, and we needed to do different things to keep that bargain with the government authorities. For example, we needed to make sure that we weren't paying insiders under any circumstance, even small insider claims. So we haven't paid a dime to the insiders or to those associated with the insiders, in part because even if it was a practical compromise you might propose in a bankruptcy, we haven't done so because to do so would be inconsistent with the spirit of our understanding with the government regulators.
Right. And given the difficulty of starting off this case and the circumstances surrounding it, I think it's hard to look at the disclosure statement and the return rates and all this work that we've been discussing for the last 40 minutes or so and not consider it to be a pretty remarkable result. And obviously, the story of FTX is not over, but I really appreciate you guys taking the time to sit down and tell at least this little piece of it with us on the podcast. So thank you for your time.
It's our pleasure. Happy to come back again when it's all over.
I think we'll probably take you up on that invitation. But until then, thank you as always to our listeners for checking out this episode. For this and the next couple of them, we'll publish under both the LegalLend and the DebtWired labels to make the transition a little bit easier before we move all the way over in March. If you're not already a cross subscriber, follow the DebtWired page on Spotify or Apple Podcasts to find us going forward. And as always, you can find plenty more insight and analysis in the form of thousands of articles on the DebtWire website. We'll see you next time.